Welcome to another edition of The Spirit Revolution. My name is Philip Cubbins.
My name is Kathleen McGowan.
And today's special guest is Patrick Bernow. Patrick Bernow is something of the mythomapper of mysteries to do with Flanders and Belgium. And Patrick and I have known each other for almost a decade, actually longer than a decade. And ever since, Patrick has continued to write about the mysteries of Flanders, making these mysteries available to the Flemish people and more recently also to an international audience. Patrick, welcome to the show.
Hi, Philip and Kathleen. It's an honor for me from this little country called Belgium to be here with you.
The pleasure is all ours. And just to give you, just to give our listeners a bit of background to what you have been doing, Patrick. I mean, there's so much to talk about, but we'll begin to focus on something which I think is probably where you are most famous for in Belgium, and mm-hmm. which you've also been written about a bit in English. And we will give people guides to what you have written from our website. And everybody knows about the great Renaissance painters of Botticelli. We will mention him, Leonardo da Vinci, all of these other painters like Michelangelo. But mm-hmm. there was a Flemish painter who lived roughly half a century before them. And his name was Jan van Eyck. And he was credited at one point with actually inventing the painting with oils. Mm-hmm. He was a remarkable painter. The Arnolfini marriage hangs in the National Gallery. Everything is of a divine nature. But his most famous painting, which hangs in Ghent, a Flemish city, is called The Mystic Lamb. It's a beautiful piece of art. It's world-renowned for being an incredibly detailed, kind of like when you see photographs of some of the detail, you even wonder how he possibly could have painted this. It's so minute. And in Belgium, it received mythical acclaim because in 1934, two panels were stolen, one of John the Baptist and one of the judges. And the one of John the Baptist was returned, but the one of the judges has been lost since 1934. So this has created decades of interest within Flanders and Belgium as a whole as to what has happened to this painting. Now, most of the people to do with this painting just treat it as a detective story. But mm-hmm. what you have done in Belgium is really add a mythical dimension to the painting, if not also the crime. So what is it about the Just Judges that is so much more... and what is it about Jan van Eyck that is so much more than just a painting?
Yeah. Well, there is a lot more. If you want to start with Jan van Eyck, we don't know what he has painted in this of this mystic lamp. Some say he had a brother, Hubert, but it's not sure that Hubert ever existed. We don't know that. There is not one single letter that we have, and we don't know he was a real person, this Hubert. That's mystery number one. Mystery number two, it's the beautiful light, the colors that are still so bright after more than 500 years, and people think, and I also think that Jan van Eyck was an alchemist. And that's mystery number two. Mystery number three is the history of the mystic lamp. And I only want to give you one example. In 1816, some of the panels were sold by the bishop. Sold for 100,000 guilders, and the bishop knew he could get four times more of it. Why did he sold these panels for only 100,000 guilders? That's one of the, for me, it was one of the great mysteries of the mystic lamp. I couldn't understand why he did that. And yeah, of course, there was the Just Judges stolen in 1934. This panel is, when you stand before the mystic lamp, you see next to the Just Judges is a panel called the Knights of Christ. And this panel, well, it's showing the Templars. And what are the Templars doing? Because the Templars were not that Catholic. They were burned on the stake. What are they doing here? People ask. And I ask myself, too, what are they doing here? And that are, for me, are the mysteries of the mystic lamp. There's only I have to say one thing. That's about the lamp in the middle, the panel called the Adoration of the Lamp. It's the greatest panel of them all. And you have a lamp there. It's a symbol of Christ, and it's pouring blood in a chalice. And of course, that's the Grail. But if you see a symbol like this, the Grail, and if you see the Templars there, you get a story that's not a story that is told in the usual, the common art books. And at that moment, you're in the land of mysteries. Here were the questions I was asking myself, what are they doing here?
I had the absolute pleasure of being in Ghent to see this altarpiece with you, Patrick, the world's best tour guide to this piece of art. And I want to just jump in for my American friends who are not necessarily familiar with this particular piece of art and say, first of all, we're going to have it up on the Spirit Revolution so people can see some photographs of it. But I just wanted to explain to our listeners for a moment, this is not just a painting. This is an altarpiece, and I believe it's 24 panels, if I'm not mistaken. It is an enormous room-filling piece of art. In order to view it, you have to walk around an entire case that fills this chapel. And you could stay there for hours and still not see everything. It's not only exquisitely beautiful, the colors, the imagery, but it is enormous as a work of art. And there are so many different panels that you can dissect and look at and try to figure out. But for me, a couple of things were very clear. It's very clear that there is a complicated and important story being told in this work of art. It is very clear that every single brushstroke of this work is considered. There is nothing here that's random or accidental. Everything was very carefully placed. And there's a lot of enigmas in this painting. For example, there are pagan writers and Jewish philosophers. There are a lot of women in this painting, which is certainly one of the things that I was struck by. There's an entire panel of just female martyrs. It's so hard to even know where to start because the painting itself is so mysterious just upon looking at it. I wanted to touch on what you said first because you did a great job of laying out all the different mysteries that there are around this particular piece of art. And first is authorship. When you're in Ghent, there is a gigantic statue of the two Van Eyck brothers, but we don't even know that there really were two. I mean, to your point, there is not any real evidence that there was a Hubert Van Eyck.
There is only one place where you do find his name, and that's on this Ghent altarpiece. There you find his name, but there is not one single letter that contains his name, not one document that's about Hubert van Eyck. We only know him because his name is on the Ghent altarpiece. That's all. What has he done besides this Ghent altarpiece? Nothing. Or is he? Maybe it's. I think he is the real master behind Jan, or perhaps he is Jan van Eyck. maybe there. But Jan van Eyck was a painter who was working for the Duke of Burgundy. Perhaps he couldn't say all he wanted to say as Jan van Eyck. And he needed a second fellow, a brother or something. And he invented Hubert van Eyck in order to say things he himself couldn't say. That's a possibility, I think.
Can you tell us a little bit, Patrick, about who this altarpiece was created for? It, who commissioned it? Who was the? Where was the, this? Is certainly a very expensive piece of artwork. Somebody paid a lot of money to have this commissioned. Can you give us some information about who might have been the financial and also potentially the spiritual impetus for this painting?
Yeah, the man who he's on the painting too. He's on one of the panels. Is Joost Veit. He was a major of Ghent. He was a wealthy merchant, but and his lady Elisabeth Boulut, they commissioned the mystic lamp, but that's the official version. In reality, I don't think they were the people who have paid Jan van Eyck to make this altarpiece, because it was meant to be in their chapel in what's now the cathedral, and what was then a more ordinary church. I think the real meaning of the work and the real the people who commissioned it were other people, because one of the a trail of symbols you're seeing here in this painting is related to the Crusades, and perhaps some people wanted to start a new Crusade in the times of Jan van Eyck, and I think that's one of the possibilities after the mystic lamp, why it was painted. It had maybe something to do with organizing a new crusade, I think.
And there's also another theory which goes around in Flanders quite recently, that it might have something to do with a council, and that somehow it was painted for the council, but that when that didn't finish as it was expected to finish, that it somehow ended up in Ghent?
Mm-hmm. Yes. But that's a very dark story and a very complicated. It's with the Council of Nicaea and that sort of things. But I think it's very for me it's I think it's more down to not down to art, but it's something more simple. When I see here, and that's for me the big question, what are the Templars doing here? And they are carrying the shield of the Templars. They are carrying the banner of the Templars. This this Knights of Christ, what are they doing here? The Templars were how do you say it? In 30 and 7 were put on the stake. They were not so Catholic. How do you say it?
They were excommunicated and burned. Yes.
Yeah. Well, what are they doing here? That's the question. They are the greatest sinners, and they are here on this masterpiece of Christianity. But I don't know what they are doing here, and that's for me the main question.
And it's definitely a very interesting one. And also the timing of the painting seems to have had a connection with the Order of the Golden Fleece. Is that correct?
The Golden Fleece, it's not my it's not my cup of tea. It's in the same period and so, but I think Jan van Eyck was telling here the story of the Grail and the Grail keepers you have the fountain in the front of the Adoration of the Lamp, one of the panels, the Fountain of Life. You have all these inscriptions, and they are pointing in the same direction. All of them are symbols telling us about the Grail, telling us about a story that is related to the history of Templars too, and that's for me the main issue here.
So, one of the things that occurred to me as I was looking at the painting is, again, this is more than just a painting. This is more than just a beautiful piece of art. There's a story going on here. To me, it feels like there is an enormous amount of storytelling going on through symbolism. Do you agree that it is something like that, like even almost a teaching kind of tool? Or do you see those 24 panels as something different?
No, it's perfectly right. A story is being told here. I agree with that. But for me, it's important to say that I don't have the answers. I see the questions raised, but I don't have the answers. I'm in search of the answers. I'm going to charge them. That's maybe we all have to search. Using the symbols
I'd also like to talk a little bit about, let's go back to this idea of Van Eyck as an alchemist. And I'd like to hear your thoughts on that. I wanted to say first that Philip and I just came back from London, and one of the paintings we went to view was another Van Eyck in the National Gallery, the Arnolfini portrait, which is an extraordinary wedding portrait, which I'm sure you're familiar with. And for our listeners, we will also put a picture of that up. That portrait has a lot of alchemical overtones, or has certainly been believed to be such. And it was interesting, just as an interesting aside, we noticed there was a lot of security around that portrait. The security in the room was very, very heavy anytime anyone came near the Arnolfini painting. And it was just something that Philip and I observed, and we're not sure if they've had issues in the National Gallery around it or what. But it's certainly the second of the paintings of Van Eyck that we have heard of that have some kind of proof or indication that he was involved with alchemical issues. So I'd love to hear what your point of view is on Van Eyck as an alchemist and how you got involved sort of on that thread of investigation.
No, I'm pretty sure he's an alchemist. He was an alchemist. It's a bit funny. The security with the Arnolfini painting, because this matter of security in the context of the Mystic Lamp, that's something completely different. The church, who is the more or less the owner of the Mystic Lamp, that in throughout the whole history of the Mystic Lamp, they didn't seem to want it. They sold panels of it. Panels were stolen, And they didn't do nothing. In 1934, there were. It was said that some panels of the Mystic Lamp could be stolen. And then it happened. And they didn't do nothing. The thief of the just judges asked a ransom, and they wouldn't pay it. They only wanted to pay 20,000 francs for it. And that 20,000 francs in 1934, that wasn't a big deal. And that for me is I do find this very, very strange.
Absolutely. And then the church doesn't want it, but when Germany invades Belgium, the Nazi regime begins to do a very detailed search for the missing panel, trying to recover it, because the idea was that if they could recover it, it was going to be presented to Adolf Hitler by the Nazi regime as a birthday present.
Yep,
so
yep.
There definitely was, it's known to have been an extraordinary piece of art. The Nazis clearly recognized it at the same time, the 30s, the 1940s time frame, yet the church says, could we please get rid of it?
Yeah, yeah. That's the main issue. The church wanted to get rid of it, the Nazis wanted to get it. I think the thief, Arsène Goudertier, who had something to do with it, but we don't know exactly what. I think he in first worked for the Nazis to steal the just judges, and then he double crossed them. That's one of my theories regarding the theft of the judges.
Just to kind of, your books haven't been translated into English. We will put the listeners to the web pages which you have put together on this and some other material. But I'm saying this, so you don't have to agree or disagree. It'll be on my back. But there has been a book in Dutch which was called Satan's Song, which has been translated into English as The Secret of the Sacred Panel. It's written by a guy called Carl Hammer. And he has collated a number of books together into a novel. And one of the books which he has used is your book. So people can kind of like get a copy of his book and kind of like basically read your story, which he has carefully preserved. So he weaves it into a big conspiracy theory. He says that the Van Eyck panel, the Van Eyck painting, has got to do with all the Arma Christi, which he sees as the various pieces of things like the True Cross, the Crown of Thorns, all of these issues. Where do you stand on that? Do you feel that Jan Van Eyck was trying to say something like that? Do you feel that the Nazis were trying to do something like that? Or do you have a different opinion on that?
No. I agree with Carl Hammer, because it was in my book also, 20 years ago, in Mysteries of the Mystic Lamp. I did believe that the Grail was the Holy Blood, and the whole story of the Holy Blood and the Holy Grail being a symbol for Christ and the bloodline. We have in Bruges, and Jan van Eyck lived and worked also in Bruges. That's about 50 kilometers from Ghent, 30 miles or so. We have the Holy Blood there too. And who brought the Holy Blood of Christ to what was then Flanders. Belgium didn't exist in the Middle Ages. Well, the Templars did it. They brought the Holy Blood to Bruges, and it is still there. It is the Holy Blood still has a procession here every year. People can see it. People can almost touch it. Now, if the Holy Blood is the Holy Grail, and the Holy Grail is on the mystic lamp, the Templars are there too. And if the Holy Blood is a symbol for Christ and for the bloodline, that's maybe the reason why the Nazis were that interested. They wanted to make their own religion. They wanted to get rid of all the old religions. If they could prove that Christ was married and had children, that would be a big point for them. And that's what I think is the main mystery of the mystic lamp.
One of the things that I really loved about this painting, and that I think that my readers would really respond to, is the number of women in the painting. And first mm-hmm. of all, the portrayal of the Great Mary, the Virgin Mary, in this altarpiece is, I think, arguably the most beautiful painting of the Virgin Mary in history. I think she's absolutely magnificent. And there is a real love and passion that is poured into these women that are in the Mystic Lamb. It's really, from that point of view for me, as an emotional observer of art, of this kind of religious and spiritual art, there is something really magical that is going on with the portrayal of women here. And I also think that this is a big part of, quote, the secret of this painting. One of the panels has a grouping of women who are martyrs. Most of them are holding the martyr's palm. Some of them are holding their symbols, their attributes that tell you which saints they are. But this is a very strong bloodline concept for those with eyes to see and ears to hear. And this is what I write about, this idea that these women who we look at throughout early Christian history as martyrs and as saints were all bloodline women. These were mm-hmm. all the daughters, the granddaughters, the great-granddaughters, the descendants of Jesus and Mary Magdalene, who are carrying not just the bloodline in their wombs, but are also carrying the knowledge. These are the keepers of the Grail. These are the women who have the knowledge that goes all the way back to the very, very beginning of early Christianity. And so I have never seen a piece of art that shows this as clearly as the Mystic Lamb. So I just wanted to say that. I think that there are so many references to the bloodline secrets, not just in terms of DNA and genetics, but in terms of the spirituality and the secrets that are being passed here, the Cathar secrets, the secrets that are protected by the Templars. And that is what I think is extraordinary. But my other question is, did the Nazis and others actually feel that there was some kind of intrinsic power in the artwork itself? Is that why it was about possession, ultimately, of one or more of these pieces? And the second piece of that question, Patrick, is why the just judges, of all of the panels that could have been stolen, why do you think this particular panel is the one?
To the first question, yes, I think the Nazis felt the power, but they felt the power like I do feel this power. It's for me, it's a power that has to do with questions, with things we are not certain about, feeling, not knowing. you don't find the answers, but you feel there is something there. That's one of the things. another thing is there are so much symbols and elements of a story here, and all these elements of a story are pointing in the same direction. If you say it's about the bloodline, it's if you say it's about the Grail family, if you say it's about the history of the Grail family, well, all the main players in this history, well, they are here. And they are here together, and that's for me, that's the power of the mystic lamp. It's all there. And why? Second question: why is the panel of the judges stolen? It's when you look at it, it's your first idea is this is one of the more common pieces. There are judges on it. The panel next to it, there are Knights of Kites on it. There are Templars on it. That's the other panels are showing hermits and pilgrims and the woman of the woman you're speaking about. Now, why these judges? Well, I think there was something hidden in the panel. The panel was rather thick. It's oak. It's 4 centimeters. And I think there was something hidden in it. And that's why the judges were stolen. Because the panel also was sawed in two, was made in two pieces. why did they do it, such a thing? That's what I'm calling myself.
What do you think was hidden inside it?
A message, not a message in a bottle, but a message in a painting in an oak panel. That's why they have sawed the panel in two pieces. Jan the Baptist and the judges. And why did they do that? Why did they do such a thing that they were searching something? I think that's a possibility.
So, do you think they? I mean, I believe if I remember correctly, the panels were sewn into two at the end of the 19th
yeah.
century. Do you think it was found then? Do you think that? It is just in this panel, or do you think, because there were other panels which were sawn at that moment in time, do you think that all of them contain something? And do you think that is related to the theft, or how do you position all of these pieces?
There were certain two in a museum in Berlin. One thing. I think they didn't find what they wanted to find, what they were looking for, and that I think that was the reason why the justice had to be stolen again. That's the case here.
Okay, so we are 60 years on. The judges is still officially missing. You have written books about its disappearance. Do you think it's ever going to be found again?
No, I think it doesn't exist anymore. It was stolen, and the thief thought they would pay for it, and he wanted to give it back, and maybe it. It was 2 months, maybe, but now it's more than 50, more than 70 years, and I think it doesn't exist anymore. I think it's lost forever, and that's a pity.
That's absolutely a gigantic loss. So we have kind of covered the Flemish mysteries somewhat. There are still hundreds to discuss with you, but moving from one mystery to another, another mystery you have been involved with and which you share lots in common with of focusing on it, first of all, is the mystery of a abbey in the southern parts of Belgium called Orval, mm-hmm. which you have written about in novel form. It's obviously part of Kathleen's The Book of Love. You have added quite an interesting dimension to Orval in the sense that you have linked it with Nostradamus. Mm-hmm. So could you briefly introduce us to how you put those that tremendously often quoted person in the context of a medieval abbey, which so many people have written about and really have focused on, but you really have added that Nostradamus dimension to it.
Mm-hmm. I have written some books for children and young adults, and one of these books is called The Treasure of Orval, because treasure stories and young adults, they love it. And that's the way I was researching some issues about Orval, and one of the things we have to say that is the old abbey. When we visit Orval, you see a new abbey and you see an old abbey. The old abbey was sacked, was burned to the ground during the French Revolution. And why it was sacked, why it was burned by the French troops, because Louis XVI and Marie Antoinette were flying from Paris. They wanted to reach Montmédy in the northeast of France. They wanted to start a counter-revolution. They sent a war chest ahead, and they were arrested in Varennes, half the way to Orval. But they were on their way to Orval, to Montmédy. Montmédy and Orval. Montmédy is in France. Orval is in Belgium, but it's on the border. It's only 12, 13 kilometers from Orval to Montmédy. And Montmédy is a fortress town, and they had an army there, and they had to pay the army, and that's the reason why they had this war chest too. And we know all that. It's not legends or something. It's plain history. That's one thing. The war chest was lost. We don't know where it. When it was hidden, we think it was hidden in Orval. And we think also that Orval was sacked and burned by the French troops because of this war chest. And because Louis XVI was given a refuge there. That's one thing. Another thing that is that we know that Marie Antoinette and Louis XVI were communicating with the royalists and with Marie Antoinette, the brother, was the emperor of Austria, and they couldn't write their letters because the revolutionaries were everywhere, and they read their letters. Their letters had to be coded. They had to be coded messages about when we want to fly, when and where this war chest has to be hidden, and how the counter-revolution has to be made, and that sort of things. And okay, that's one thing. Now, if you see, if you look at the quatrains of Nostradamus, you find a lot of quatrains about a treasure, but you also find quatrains with Orval in it, and with a temple and with ruins. You even find a root in it, and I think that they have used some quatrains of Nostradamus, and they have written other quatrains, and they have invented prophecies, and they have said this is written by Nostradamus to communicate with each other in a code that could not be broken, because they knew it was Nostradamic code. That's what I think was the matter here with Louis XVI and Marie Antoinette and this treasure of Orval. Now, Nostradamus lived in Orval. We know that for sure. There is a garden with all sort of herbs in it, and Nostradamus was interested in that sort of things. He has made a lot of travels, and he has lived for a few years in the Abbey of Orval. People say that he might have written a prophecy that's called the Prophecy of Orval, and that's attributed to sometimes to a man named Olivarius, but it could be an other name for Nostradamus. And in this prophecy of Orval too, we see the same symbols, we see the same story is unfolding here. And we also think that some parts of it are written by Nostradamus, and other parts are written by royalists or monarchists who are with Louis XVI and Louis XVII. Is some that could have died in the temple prison or not, and that they were communicating with each other using these Nostradamic quatrains and prophecies. Old ones and new ones.
When I first met you and you started revealing some of these stories about Orval to me, I was just completely mesmerized by them, and I still am. A lot of this information is historically earth-shattering. This is big stuff, and yet nobody talks about it. There are so many ways to go in discussing this. I want to go back for a minute. You say definitively that we know that Nostradamus lived in Orval for a few years. To me, that is a revelation. That is extremely important for a lot of reasons, certainly in the work that I do. My questions are, how do we know that? Where is that information coming from? And at what stage in Nostradamus' life do you believe that we can prove he was in Orval?
After his first wife died, he made some travels. And he traveled through Europe. And one of the places he went to was Orval. It's in some of his biographies. But also there are some stories in Orval and in Florenville. It's a small city not far from Orval. And these stories are mentioned too, that Nostradamus was living here because he was fascinated by the herbs garden of medicinal herb garden of the abbey that was rather famous. If you look at this, some of these quatrains, then you can place them in Orval. You see some there's an oak, very big oak, and people were saying he was sitting there under that oak, and he was writing there. And some of his quatrains are about an oak struck by lightning and that sort of things. That it's yeah. A lot of elements. There is no definite proof he was there, but there is much circumstantial evidence that he was there.
So we move forward in time to Marie Antoinette and Louis XVI and their flight out of Paris. And this idea that they were going to Orval is also a huge revelation for me. But what I wanted to clarify, because I don't understand it entirely, and I think it's really interesting, so I want to make sure I'm getting this right, is that you believe that they may have been communicating back and forth in something similar to the quatrains or some other kind of encoded communication. Is that what you're saying?
Yep. They had, there are a lot of quatrains in Nostradamus, and written by Nostradamus and published by Nostradamus. And if you look at these quatrains, you can find here the story of a monarch, a great monarch, and the story of Louis XVI and Marie Antoinette and people and a revolution and a temple and ruins and all these elements. Now when Louis XVI and Marie Antoinette were fleeing out of Paris, they were arrested at Varennes. This small city in France, and in an hotel called the Great Monarch. But Nostradamus has written about this Great Monarch. I think that the people, Count Fersen and so, and General de Bouillet, who were organizing this escape of the King and the Queen of France, they have used this quatrains. They have seen, it's about us, of it could be about us, and they have used these quatrains to communicate with each other, but also they have written quatrains in the style of Nostradamus, and they have made up prophecies attributed to Nostradamus, but in fact they were writing it, and all in order to talk to each other. When can we get out of Paris? Which roads are safe? How can we deal with the revolution? Where do we have to hide? Where can we hide? What are safe places for the war chest? And all that sort of things. We know that much messages were found by the revolutionaries, so they had to find a safe way to talk to each other, and I think they used Nostradamus for it.
And you believe that their ultimate destination before they were apprehended in Varennes was Orval?
It was Orval. That's absolutely sure. There is no doubt about it. They wanted to. There are letters from Madame Campan, a lady in waiting for Marie Antoinette. There are letters from Count Fersen, the lover of Marie Antoinette, of our friend who was organizing the escape from Paris. There are letters from General de Bouillet, and they are all saying the same thing. We have a fortress town in France, northeast of France, and we want to get the king there and the royal family there. They will be safe there. But we have an army also there, and there are mercenaries coming, German mercenaries coming. They have to be paid. We will get them to Montmédy. But if it's Montmédy is no good place for a king and a queen and a royal family to live, if it's too dangerous to remain there in Montmédy, well, it's only 13 kilometers on the other side of the border in the Austrian Netherlands, and that was the country of Marie Antoinette, Orval was was a part of Austria and in that period, and the emperor of Austria was her brother, so she would be safe there. It was only 12 kilometers. They could be in France, and 1 hour later, or they would be out of France, and they would be safe in Orval. The monks of Orval were preparing rooms and were preparing dinner for them. We know that they have written about it in their memoirs and in their letters and so on. So there is no doubt about it. It was meant to be. They were arrested at the Great Monarch, and who is in all these quatrains written by Nostradamus? Well, a great monarch. That can be. There has to be some. There has to be a meaning in it.
I can only imagine what history would have looked like if they had made it those extra 12 kilometers to Orval, and had been able to meet up with the Habsburg forces and had been able to meet up with the reinforcements. I mean, do you ever speculate about that? Do you ever think, you know, gosh, how different would history have looked if they had been able to escape?
Yeah. Yes, because history has been very unkind for Louis XVI and Marie Antoinette. We are living now with lies. You read lies, downright lies in books about Louis XVI and Marie Antoinette. They weren't that awful kings and queens. They weren't. People say Marie Antoinette was she was light-hearted, yes, but she wasn't that awful woman. She was a caring mother. She loved her husband. And Louis XVI, he was a monarch of a new type. Monarch. He wasn't the Sun King. He wasn't an. He wasn't a tyrant. They have made a tyrant about of him, but he wasn't that. He wanted to. He didn't want to shed blood, and that's the reason why they were arrested. The troops of General de Bouillé were there in Varennes, and they said, well, we can liberate you. But we have to shoot. The king said, no, I don't want to shed blood of French people. All is said with that.
Patrick, one final question, and it's tying it back to Nostradamus and Orval. Do you think he was there for a specific purpose? Do you think that he went there for a very specific reason, or do you think it was just one of those things?
No, I don't think it was just one of those things. Okay, it was strategy. Orval was near Montmédy, so that's fine. Okay, Orval in Austria, Austrian Netherlands, and Montmédy in France, that's okay. But there is more to the history of Orval than only the story of Louis XVI, only the story of Nostradamus. And here we go again, but I can't help it. Maurice Maeterlinck, the one Nobel Prize winner we have here in Belgium, or we had here in Belgium, as a playwright. One of his famous plays, Pelléas and Mélisande, and a play that won the Nobel Prize with music of from Debussy on it. Well, that's a Merovingian play, Pelléas and Mélisande. You have to read it, or you have to watch it, or you have to listen to the music and listen to the story. It's a play about the keepers of the bloodline. It's a Merovingian play. Maurice Maeterlinck, it's the words of Maurice Maeterlinck, and it's a play about Orval. It's the same story. If the story about the well and the lost ring, and the wedding ring in the water and the fountain, and well, you find it in Léas and Mélisande, and you find it in Orval. It's a story of Orval. It's their symbol, the trout with the ring. That's one thing. Another thing is that if you find quatrains in Nostradamus and you can locate these quatrains, or you can bring them in touch with places of in Orval, you can also place the story of the Templars in Orval, because there are also a lot of quatrains in Nostradamus that can be analyzed as telling a story about a Templar treasure, about a Templar secret, and Orval. Well, maybe there is more between Earth and Heaven than we are dreaming of in our wildest dreams, or something like that.
Well, I definitely believe that art and heaven go together. I also believe that your research is heaven. And I really do want to state that. I want to thank you for not just being here today, but for being so generous with your time and your knowledge and your information to me personally over the last couple of years. And I just want to say to my English-speaking listeners that we will get some information up there so you can read some of Patrick's articles in English. We are working hard on trying to see more of his work translated into English, because for my money, I just want to say that I think you are the most original, the most thorough, the most inspiring and fascinating researcher out there working today, and it's really been a pleasure to know you.
Thank you.
We are the Spirit Revolution. Our special guest today was Patrick Bernau. If you want to revisit this interview, you can do so on the BBS Radio Archive. You can also go to our website, which is thespiritrevolution.com. And we are also on iTunes, where you just have to search for The Spirit Revolution and you will find us. But until next week, until then, from Kathleen and myself,
the truth against the world.